Okay. To throw stones upon Moshe Rabbeinu, upon Kalev, upon Yehoshua, right? And see him, and then the next verse says, "Uchvod Hashem nirob ohel moed," and the glory of the Lord appeared in the ohel moed, in the tent of meeting, right? So Omer Rabbi Chiya Barabo said, "Melamed, this teaches us, shenotlu avonim uzrakum kalape mala," that the people not only wanted to throw their stones at those who came back, you know, who told them that they should go on with the conquest of Eretz Yisrael, namely Moshe and, you know, Yeshua and Kalev, but actually they took their stones and they threw it up to the sky, as if they were stoning the Rabbeinu Shalom himself, to be honest. Okay?
Who's them that they're talking about here?
What?
He said the people throwing stones at them.
Right.
But
I said, by the them, it meant Moshe Rabbeinu.
Could it also be the spies?
No. Because it was the spies who incited them to do all these things. You know, the 10 spies.
Okay.
So they didn't want to stand to hear a report favoring Eretz Yisrael in the conquest. So they threw stones at them, but according to this mimer over here, according to this statement, they're also showing their contempt of the Rabbeinu Shalom, as we read just before, that Kichazaku Kiyotzuhu Mimenu, that even the Rabbeinu Shalom isn't strong enough to enable us to dispossess the Canaanites and to conquer their land, you see. They had no faith. They had lost their faith in the Rabbeinu Shalom. Vayomusu anoshim motzi divaso tzarov amageifa. All right, and the people who had spread this evil report about Eretz Yisrael died, and it's written ba mageifa.
Plague.
In the plague, or with the plague. They died with the plague. Now, normally, if we want to say they died in a plague, then what would it be? B'magefa, okay? Mm-hmm. If it says ba-magefa, then the implication is that this was a special kind of a plague that the Rebbeinu Shalom sent among them. Omer Rab Shimon ben Lakish, Rab Shimon ben Lakish said, Shemesu misa mishuna, that they died literally a strange death. In other words, it means in like some sort of an unnatural death. Misa mishuna. You may have heard this expression in Yiddish too. Yeah, it's part of the traditional curse words in Yiddish.
What is that? What does it mean?
So, Stabenah Misa
Mishunah.
Strange death, literally. But it means may die an unnatural death.
So, that's what the word Misa Mishunah
means? Yeah, that's what Misa Mishunah means, right.
Never knew that.
Yeah.
No, use the
first one. Let's see how these expressions from the Gemara become embedded in Yiddish.
Unnatural means premature.
Pardon me?
Unnatural implies premature.
Prematurely or accidentally or with some kind of a horrible fate, maybe by, dying by fire or drowning or whatever. Maybe these are all misfortunes, okay?
Sometimes they use
not dying a natural death in bed, okay? So because, you know, you live a good lifespan.
Okay.
Sometimes they use it to imply poisoning. Somebody, they say, died in a natural death.
Yeah. You mean legally they're using it now in the law that you read?
Yeah, right. A natural death would be, you know, homicide. It might be poisoning or something.
It's interesting how, you see again, how words which come from the Talmud suddenly take on a different meaning or a brand new meaning or something around in modern Hebrew. We've had other cases of that too as we've gone along. Omer Rabbi Chanina bar Papa, Rabbi Chanina bar Papa said, Dorash Rav Shila, he said that Rav Shila interpreted this verse. He was Ish Kefar Tamarto. He came from a place called the village of Tamarto. Tamarto, of course, would be from the word Tomer, in other words, palm trees, the city of palm trees, the village of palm trees. Melamed, he says, that teaches us, Shanishtarbe v'lishoinim v'dofal tipurim, show that these people who use their lashon, they use their tongue in order to denounce Eretz Yisrael, their tongue suddenly grew long, right? and it fell right down to their belly button. That's what the dibur is. And worms came out of their tongue, right? And the worms crawled into their belly button, and from their belly button, they came right back again into their tongues. So that this is the Misa Mishunah, in other words, that they had. That because of Lashon Hara, wherein they used their tongues, were evil, so it's like poisonous words, worms. So, okay, no. We're out. Nachum by Yitzchok. My book, it's torn over here, but I think what it says over there, it says Be'askara, right?
Yeah.
They died with Askara. Now, what is Askara? We had that word before in another place in the Talmud.
That's Krupp
here. Huh? So what's Krupp?
Whooping cough.
Okay, either whooping cough or diphtheria. I think it's diphtheria, frankly. Because with diphtheria, I know, I mean, I still remember as a child that, and my sisters had it in Harlem, and I remember being vaccinated at the age of about 5 or so for diphtheria.
What is the difference between whooping cough and diphtheria?
Well, whooping cough is a cough.
Okay.
It's not good, but on the other hand, you don't usually die from it, except as an extreme case.
I can tell her my daughter was, she was 2 years old, plus 4.
Yeah.
And she had croup, meaning diphtheria, because at some point she became blue, she couldn't breathe, and she was...
Yeah. Wow. You see, the circulation gets cut off in the throat, right? Right. Circulation becomes cut off over here in the throat. This is what it is.
That's the face that you have.
Like you choke to death, right?
Yeah.
If in an extreme case, right?
That's what happens in whooping cough. The same thing.
Yeah.
Your bronchial tubes collapse. That's what happens in whooping cough. And you can't breathe.
Your ear circulation.
I had it twice, so I know what it is.
Yeah. As an adult or as a child?
How old were you?
I was an adult. It was the second time.
Yeah.
Because the adult was worse.
Oh, yeah.
Much worse. I had to take Kenny out of 1 year of school because I got a call from the school. They had whooping cough.
Uh-huh.
I had to bring them home.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Well, obviously, they were lied to each other.
Very much alike.
Right. Yeah.
I had the same thing. I couldn't stop coughing. I started going to bed and I started coughing. And they gave me a shot.
Okay, let me take a look at yours because it got torn over here and it's not clear to me. Okay, so only one line. All right. Okay. All right. Now, all of a sudden, they go back again to crossing the Jordan. As I said, it sort of swings back and forth, back and forth. So after talking about crossing the Jordan, they got involved with the spies. Right? And now, again, let's get back again to crossing the Jordan. All right. So remember, we said that what happened when they crossed the Jordan? When the Kohanim came and their feet stepped into the Jordan River. So the miracle was that the water stopped flowing and instead it kept piling up, 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 up. But the water below where the feet of the Kohanim were, it was dry, and then the various tribes were able to go. Whether they went, as we said,
single file,
or did they go in the order in which they were encamped in the wilderness, where, you know, three tribes here, three tribes there, and so on and so forth. But at any rate, they crossed. Okay. So now the Gemara continues over here. Okay. I better... just for a moment. Right. Okay. All right. Now it says, "V'kevon she'olah ha'achmon she'b'Yisrael min ha'yarden," and when the last Israelite, meaning, of course, you know, everybody except the Kohanim, right, got up from the Jordan River, you know, they rose. In other words, they got up on the other bank, you know. So chosru mayim le'mekomah. Then the waters returned to their place. She'ne'emar, as the pasuk says. And it came to pass that when the Kohanim, who were carrying the Ark of the Covenant of God, arose from the Jordan River, Nitku kapos raglei kohanim lecharavo. The feet of the kohanim stuck to the dry land. Vayoshuvu meha yardin lemkomon, and the waters of the Jordan returned to their customary place. Vayelchu kismol shel shom, and they continued going literally. In other words, they flowed even as they had yesterday and the day before. Al kol gedosa.
Banks.
Through all its banks. Okay, in other words, probably it means even that it overflowed the banks, the banks at this particular one, because you can imagine a rush of water coming down. Naturally, it's going to be flooding over there. All right, but the difficulty that they have over here is the idea that nitku, which means it was stuck, literally, or attached, okay? That the feet of the kohanim were attached. So the question is, I would take the pshat, in other words, the obvious meaning, or shall I say the simple meaning, that it says when all of Betocha Yardin, right, when the people pass, so that it means that they also got El HaCharavot, that they also climbed up on the dry land. But that's not what it says over here. Okay? What does it say? What it says is that there they were, stuck on dry land, but not yet on the side where the people of Israel were. So, as a result, what do we find? We find Nimsa Aron Venosa. So we find that the ark and those who were carrying it, the Kohanim and the other priests, Mitzad Echad, they were on one side. In other words, they were still like on the Jordanian side, right? On the Transjordan side, the Yisrael Mitzad Echad, and the Israelites were on the other side. In other words, what we would call, they were on the west, right? No? I don't want to say the West Bank. I don't like that. Except it's not a bad bank to do business with.
Locally.
Excuse me.
Was it a saving bank? Or
a West Bank? Yeah, it's a commercial bank. But if you go to, you know, they have a branch in the Stop and Shop in East Longmeadow. They give you a special rate on the savings that's higher than practically anybody else around over here.
So you use them now?
Yeah, why not? I may as well get a higher interest.
West Bank, huh?
West Bank, right.
Doctor,
yes.
The heat not take means to disconnect oneself. Will not take means to disconnect or break contact.
Right. That's correct. That's the real meaning of the word. Yes. As for example, that famous poem by Lamden, right? Od lo dutka hashalshalot. The chain has not yet been broken or disconnected, and so on. That's correct. Right. Yeah. Okay. All right. So, at any rate, this is the understanding that they had, that they were still stuck over there. So the question is, if the waters are flowing right now, so how did the Kohanim, those who were carrying the ark, how did they get across? Understand? We're talking about miracles over here. Okay? Okay. So it says, Nosa Aron es Nosa Aron, the Ovar. Says that, so they interpreted that the ark itself carried across those who were carrying it. In other words, right, miraculously, okay, it crossed and then carried them. Shinemar, as the Pasuk says, and it came to pass when all the people had finished crossing, then the ark of the Lord and the priests also crossed before the people. Now, since this was a miracle, so now they bring in another case, and that is V'adovra zeh ne'enash uza, and it was in connection with this event that Uzzah was punished. Shinemar, because if you remember the story.
Who's Uzzah?
Okay, that's what I'm going to tell you.
That's right.
Philistines made war against the people of Israel. Okay, this was in the days of Shmuel. So okay, so at that particular point, the Kohanim, Chofni and Pinchas, who were the sons of Eli, the Kohen Gadol, right? They went with the Ark of God in order to encourage the people, and, you know, presumably to bring about victory against the Philistines. Instead, the Philistines defeated the Jews in battle, and they took captive the Ark. Okay, and then afterwards, it's written that they passed around the Ark from one city to another among the Philistine cities, and wherever it happened, all of a sudden plagues began to afflict the Philistines. So finally they decided, why do we need all this sorrow over here? So they decided that they took a wagon and some oxen over there, right? And they let the wagon go, and you know, and inside the wagon was the Ark, okay? And so the oxen went, and they came to a Jewish territory, and it stayed over there. And then they decided, in the days of David, to bring the Ark of the Lord up to Yerushalayim. Okay? And at that particular point, they put it again in a brand new wagon, but it, on the way, it suddenly looked as though the Ark was going to fall off the wagon. Okay, so Uzzah, who was accompanying the Ark, he stretched forth his hand in order to steady the Ark, which was on the cart, and his punishment was that he died. Apparently the Rebbeinu Shlomo was not happy with the fact that he dared, you know, to touch the Ark, which was sacred. Okay,
and otherwise, yes, it would have dropped, right?
Pardon me?
Otherwise it would fail.
Right, otherwise, well, he was afraid it was going to, because it's written over there, Shamto Abakar, which means, you know, that the cattle, they stumbled, and because the cattle stumbled, you know, that were dragging the ark, the wagon, so he was afraid that it would fall off, and that's why he did it.
One explanation that I read, remember the attribution, is that the anger of Hashem was directed because they did not carry it as they did in the Midbar, which would have been real kavod.
Gemara is going to mention that.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you for anticipating the Gemara.
Sorry about that. Sorry. I have another thing. Did the Philistines keep it in Ekron?
Yes, that was one of the places. Okay. Right. Yeah. Right. Okay. So, at any rate, yeah. And for this reason, as we said, Uzzah was punished. Shenemar, as it's written, Vayavor ad Goren Kidon. Now, this is in Divrei HaYamir, you know, the Book of Chronicles, where they relate, you know, the episode again, but with somewhat different names than what we have in Sefer Shmuel. Okay? They came to the threshing floor of Kidon. By Yishlach Uzzah Yazal, that Uzzah then stretched forth his hand lechoses Aaron in order to steady the ark. So Amalei Kodesh Baruch Hu, the Rebbeinu Shalom said unto him, Uzzah, Nosa of Nosa, right? Take a look. The ark was able to carry those who carried it, right? So Atzmos culture came. So don't you think that the ark was capable of carrying itself? Vayichar af Hashem be'uzah, vayakehu shom al hashal. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Uzzah, and he smote him there al hashal. Now the question is, what does the meaning of the word shal? It's an unusual word, because the word is about the only place in the Bible where we have the word shal. So there are different explanations as to what it means over there. Okay? Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Eliezer. There was a difference of opinion between Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Eliezer. Chad Omar, one of them said, he smote him, Omar, right, al iske sholu. Okay? Now, what does it mean, al iske shalu? Shalu is a word that we do find in the book of Ezra, and there it means like an error. Okay, the book of Ezra, it so happens, is partly in Aramaic and, you know, partly in Hebrew. Okay? So the Aramaic has this word, and it means like an error, mistake, or something like that. So because of his error, so in other words, shal means that, okay? Because the only other place where we have the word shal in the Torah has a different meaning altogether. The word shal in the Torah is connected with the story of Moshe Rabbeinu in the burning bush. What does it say over there concerning the burning bush? He sees this and he says, I have to go see, what is this strange, this miraculous sight, right? And so the Rabbeinu Shalom says unto him, what? Shal ni alecha mi al raglecha. How do we translate over there? We translate in the sense that take off your shoes from your feet, because this is a makom kodesh, it's a holy place, you see. But obviously that would not make any sense in this particular context. So that therefore, the first opinion that we have, probably was Rabbi Eliezer's opinion, is that it's connected with the word sholu, which we do find in the book of Ezra, namely an error. He made an error, he made a mistake, and so he was punished for that. That's one.
He
but
died.
He died, of course. Yeah. But the second one is a very unusual one, I have to tell you. V'chad omar, and the other opinion is she'osa tzarachov bifonov. Usually the word lasos tzarachov implies doing something like, for example, having to urinate, having to defecate. Sometimes it means having to fornicate. It has different ideas connected with it. Okay? Although, of course, what is the plain and simple meaning? That you do that which is necessary. Okay? So at any rate, this is what they're accusing him, according to the second opinion, that, in other words, he either urinated or defecated or something like that in the presence of the Ark. And, of course, I don't have to tell you, that was extremely disrespectful, and this is the reason why he was punished. Okay?
Let's hear that shal is connected with the root nashal, which means to drop off. Is that correct?
Well, it possibly is. It may be. But then, so what is the nashal? In that case, then you would have to say that he was afraid that the ark would drop off al hashal and then take it in that particular case. All right, it's a possibility. I don't say that it's not a possibility. It's possible. Okay? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I have to tell you, she'osetz rochav, you see, so Rashi makes the following comment. It's on the left hand column. It says, the shal, it says the word shal is loshen ki yishal tzeisecha, right? Because your olive tree, you know, will drop. In other words, instead of the olives reaching maturity, they will drop, you know, before they could reach ripeness and maturity. Right. And then we have another word, namely the word for afterbirth, v'shu yosah. This is also in the Teichecho that we find at the end of the Devarim over there. So afterbirth too. What is afterbirth? It's also, it drops out of the womb after the birth of the child, right? So that therefore, he says, this is Dover HaMutol Milmala Lamata, something which falls from above down below. But what exactly is the nature of the word shal, if we take it in that sense, is still not 100% clear to me, I have to tell you. If you want to take it in a nice sense, then you take it the way I said a moment ago, namely that he was afraid he was going to fall and so on. But I understand that there's another interpretation that it means, you know, that when you defecate, you also have something falling. Okay.
if he had not touched it, what would have happened?
If he had not touched it?
Yeah. Then
the implication here is that the ark would have been able to carry itself. Right. Okay. Now, of course, we come to a little bit more in connection with the question that you raised before. Okay? Okay. And he died there, literally with the Ark of God, but it means he died there standing by, you know, right near the Ark of God. Okay. Now, Omer Rabbi Yochanan, so Rabbi Yochanan said, Uza bo l'olam haba. He says, Uza came to the olam haba. In other words, even though he was struck by God, you know, and punished, but nevertheless, God did not deny him the his portion in olam haba. Shenemar, because it says Imarod Elohim, right? Which is, you know, we know that the literal meaning would be together with the Ark of God. Ma Aron Laolam Kayam, just as the Ark will always exist. So Af Uza Bo Leil Haba. So likewise, Uza will exist in the Olam Haba. All right. Now, since we know that this is connected with David wanting to bring the Ark, so it's written by Yichal David. And David became angry. He became angry because God literally had caused a breach with Uzzah. In other words, had killed Uzzah. He didn't, David was angry with the Ben Ishlam for it. So Omer Rabbi Elazar said, "Shenishtanu ponov kacharora." It says, "What does it mean by yichar?" Which means literally, he burned. You understand? I mean, when we say Vayichar Af, it means literally that the nose burned. But of course, we take the nose in the sense of the seat of anger. The anger burned, okay? So, the word Vayichar, it says, what happened is that Shenishtanu Ponov, David's face became like a charora. Like a charora. Charora is a cake that you put on coals, and it's baked, you know, and it's burned to a crisp. So that this is what happened. His face changed as if it were, it was burning to it with a crisp. That's how angry he was, okay? Elo beato. So now the Gemara says, you mean to tell me if that's the case, called Heichod Yisiv Yichar, that wherever it's written by Yichar, Hochiname? So it always means that the face is going to turn like a burnt cake. You understand? So he says, no, because Hosam Ksiv Af, because where it's written by Yichar Af, that means simply became angry, but doesn't mean that happened what we said happened to David over here. But Hocho Lo Ksiv Af, but here the word Af is not written. Dorash Rovo, Rovor gave the following drash. He says, Nei Mane Nash David, why was David punished? Of course, you know, all of us, you know that David was punished because of Bathsheba, right? But, you know, they tried to justify the whole incident with Bathsheba by saying that in reality, Uriah was required to give a get to his wife, and so she was divorced the moment that he left to the front, and so on. And therefore, when he died over there, it was retroactive, etc., etc., you know. They tried to justify David's actions. But, nevertheless, we know that David was punished.
He was punished.
He was punished. Well, actually, in the Bible, the child that was born to him in Bathsheba died. And, it hit him hard. He wept and so on, and until the baby was buried. And then after that, he decided, and it's a very, very poignant scene over there. He said, he started into feast, and so after fasting and not eating anything, you know, during the time that he hoped that his fasting and his prayers would save the baby's life. But when the baby died, so he decided, well, that's enough. That time is I have to get back to living again, right? And Bathsheba was very angry with him, why he did that. So he said, look, he says, this is life, he says. I will go to him, in other words, the baby. I'll be dying one of these days, in other words, and, I'll be dead like the baby. But he cannot come back to me anymore. He's not going to come back to me. So that, in other words, life has to go on the way it is. So, well, okay, I mean, needless to say, when we are faced with the problem, this is why I guess we have laws of mourning for certain specified periods. The aninus, which takes place prior, to the burial, and then after burial, the sitting shiva, and then the Shloshim, and then of course the law concerning mourning for a father or a mother for 12 months, in the sense that you abstain, you know, from going to parties, entertainments, and things like that, and so on. Okay, but the idea is again that we have to mourn, but never mourn excessively. We have to realize that life has to go on, and while we have the rules as to how to mourn and how long to mourn and so on, but we have to return to life, and you can't simply all the days of your life be in mourning and then never get out of it.
That's if you continue to mourn, it's like the fine of the will of God.
Right. Correct.
The will of God.
Right. All right, getting back to our text. All right, so it says, why was David punished? And the answer that they give is a very interesting one. It says, Mipnei shekor ledivrei Torah zemiros. David referred to the words of Torah as song. Shenemar, as the pasuk says, as a matter of fact, we read it this morning in the Tillim. It says, zemiros hayalichu kecha beveis begurai. Your statutes were like song unto me, where I live, in the house of my dwelling. Okay. So Omer lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Bnei Shalom said to him, Divrei Torah, the words of Torah, Shekosu Bahen, where it's written, Hasoif Ein Echa Bo V'Yenenu, if you gaze upon it, and it's not there anymore, in other words, you think that you can understand it, and yet you can never understand the complete Torah. It's not within the human realm to understand everything from A to Z and so on, right? And Hator Kareh Sons Miros, consider them only like songs. I will cause you to stumble in something that even school children know what is right. You'll know so. It's written in the Torah, I'm calling the rest of the pasuk, right? If you remember that at the dedication of the Mishkan, the various Nesim, they brought all kinds of gifts, right? One of the gifts that they brought, or two of the gifts, they brought cattle, and they also brought wagons, okay? But what were the wagons for? The answer is they were given to those Levites who had to schlep heavy things, such as, you know, the beams, and the various skins for the altar, and so on. But what about the holy things, the holy objects, including the Aron HaKodesh? Those had to be carried on the shoulders of the Bnei Kohath. That was their particular charge. So, that being the case, he should have realized, right, what? The Bnei Kohath lo nasan ki avodas HaKodesh aleihem, right? That they had the holy service, and therefore, how should the ark have been carried in the days of David from its place over there in Beit Shemesh and so on and brought to Yerushalayim? You understand? It should have been carried on the shoulders of the Levim or the Kohanim or something like that. The Ihu Asi Bagalta. But he, how did he bring it? He brought it in a wagon. And that's the reason why David was punished, because he should have known a simple pasuk like this. Then it's written by Yahweh Anshei Beis Shemesh Ki Ra'u Ba'aron, that God smote, God punished the inhabitants of Beit Shemesh. Hope it doesn't happen to my son.
I was
son
just
going to
say that. His name is David.
Because they looked at the ark. So the Gemara says, Meshum Deroh, because they looked. By Yah, is that why God smote them? No, it has to be something deeper than that, right? So, Rabbi Abu, Rabbi Elazar. Again, there's a difference of interpretation between Rabbi Abu and Rabbi Elazar. Chad Omar, one of them said, Kotzrin Mishtachvim Hoyu. One of them said that they were bowing down to the ark, but they were reaping, doing business at the same time. You know, it's like the famous story, Hasidic story, you know, about Rabbi Levi Yitzchak in Berditchev, that he saw a man dressed in talis and tefillin, a wagoner, you know, a balagola, and he was greasing up the wheels of his wagon, right? which was not a very proper thing to do, that here you're smearing grease on the wagon at the same time standing with dollars and tefillin. But how did Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Teitchov interpret? He said, Rabbeinu Shel Olam, look what a wonderful people you have, that even when they are engaged in doing tasks of this type, nevertheless their kavona is to heaven. So what do we have to say? This is the opposite, right? What the Gemara is saying is they, in other words, had a very poor attitude towards the Holy Ark, which was in their midst. What were they doing? They were reaping in its presence, but they should have shown greater respect. This is one interpretation. The Chado Amar, and the other interpretation is Milei Namiyot. Not only were their actions not right, he says, but even their words were not right. They saw it, and what? They said all kinds of nasty things, you know, that they acted in a way with very disrespectful in what they had to say concerning it. Okay. What did they say? They said, Man Imrich Dimreas Man Aloch Yifaisais. Says, meaning, what made you angry that you became angry? And what made you angry that now you have suddenly become reconciled? In other words, why weren't you, says Rashi, mi chischo kishe ka'asto, when you became angry, right, how is it leitzaltis atzmecho min hashivya? Why weren't you, O Ark, able to save yourself from captivity? Or, of course, the implication is, Rabbeinu Shel Olam, why weren't you able to help to save the Ark from its captivity at the time when it was captive? The Atomi Mefayeskha. And now, you know, what is it that brought you about, you know, that you become reconciled, Keshenis Payasta Love Melecha, that, you know, decided that, all right. So in other words, they were saying, look, the Ark, Ark, you're so holy, you represent the Torah of the Rabbeinu Shel Olam and so on, why couldn't you perform a miracle for yourself instead of being in captivity and so on? Alright, then it's written, Vayach Bo'om Shivim Ish, and he smote among the people 70 people, the Chamishim Elefish, and 50,000 people. Now, of course, what is the pshat? Simple meaning. Simple pshat, you know, pshat would mean that he smote 75,000 people. Okay, you understand? I mean, 50,070. All right. Okay. I mean, that's right. 50,070. Right. Okay. Correct. Okay. But the fact that they repeat the word ish each time means that obviously there's a reason for it, right? Mm-hmm. So, what is the reason? So, Rabbi Abohu, Rabbi Elazar. Again, there's a difference of opinion between Rabbi Abohu and Rabbi Elazar as to what the interpretation is. Chad, Omar, one of them said, Shivim ish are you, right? That in reality only 70 people were killed. But the Chol Echod, the Echod, every single one of the 70 is Shakul Chamishim Elef. It's as though they had the value of 50,000. In other words, they were very, very important people, and it's as if, you know, with the death of the 70, it's as if 50,000 died. The Chad Omar, the other one said, Chamishim Elefayu, taka that there were 50,000 who died, but the Chol Echod V'Yechod Shakul Keshim Sanhedrin, and each one of them was valued as if he were one of the 70 members of the Sanhedrin. In other words, these were all important people who died. Lo and behold, we're still continuing with the story of when they brought the Ark to Jerusalem, right? In the days of King David. So again, there's a difference of opinion. We'll do a couple more lines and we'll call it a night because it's 9 o'clock already. Okay. And it came to pass that when those who carried the Ark of the Lord stepped six steps, at that particular point, what happened? They sacrificed an ox and a fatted calf. Uksiv, and then the pasuk continues and says, Shiva Purim, seven oxen, Vishiva Elim, and seven rams. Now, this is the reading that we have in Divrei Hayomim in the Book of Chronicles as compared to that in Shmuel Beis. Okay? So how can you reconcile the two statements? So Omer Rapapa Bar Shmuel. So Rapapa Bar Shmuel said, I'll call Psio Psio Shorim Ri. For every single step that they took, they immediately sacrificed an ox and a fatted calf, and I'll call Shesh for Shesh Psios, and for every six steps that they took, they sacrificed Shiva Purim and Shiva Elim. They sacrificed seven oxen and seven rams. So Amalei Reb Chista said to him, In came Melesis called Eretz Yisrael Bomes. If that's the case, you filled Eretz Yisrael with all kinds of altars, because after all, how did they slaughter them? They need an altar for it, right? Because these were sacrifices. So in other words, every step, according to your interpretation, they're putting up an altar. You need so many altars in Eretz Israel, right? Elo Omer Rav Chista, but rather so Rav Chista, this is the way I understand it. I'll call Sheish V'Sheish B'Shiyos, every six steps that they took, then there was Shorim Bri, right? It was an ox and a fatted calf. But I'll call Shisho Sidorim Shel Sheish B'Shiyos, and then for every six turns of six steps, in other words, six times six times six times six times six times six, in other words, every 36, I guess it would mean, there they sacrificed Shiva Purim and Shiva Elim. Okay? They sacrificed seven oxen and seven rams. Then there's another discrepancy between the account that we have in the Book of Chronicles and that we have in Shmuel Beis. In Shmuel Beis, what did it say? It said it was Kidon, right? Siv Kidon. That was the name of the guy. Siv, but in Divrei Hayom it says Nochon. So how do you sacrifice? I mean, how do you? How can you reconcile Kidon and Nochon? So Omer Rabbi Yochanan said, Batchilo Kidon. At first, his name was Kidon, but himself Nochon. But afterwards, his name was Nochon. Now, of course, we all understand what is he trying to say. Kidon means a spear, right? A spear. Okay. So, in other words, when it first came, people died with the Magepa and everything else, and so on, right? And Uzzah was killed, and so on. But when it finally got to Yerushalayim, then it was finally Nochon, which means there it was established. Firmly, okay. All right, so we'll stop at this point. The ark, right. But they're talking about the place where the ark was to rest at this particular point. Okay, so next week, in Yitzha Hashem, we'll be meeting again at our usual time and place. And I want to wish all of you a good Tannis, have a Gringen Tannis, to have a good fast on Tisha B'Av, and may we see Yeshua Yisrael v'nachamas Yerushalayim. Okay. He decided that some of the readings in the Gemara were not correct, and so he tried to give more correct readings based either upon the meaning or based upon parallel passages that you find in other places. Now, another one who did it was the Rashal, Reb Shlomo Luria. He also did that. And of course, at a later period, getting a little closer to our time, it was the Vilna Gaon who did that. And as a matter of fact, even Reb Moshe Feinstein, you know, in our own age, he also, you know, tried to correct some of the passages and so on, because
you
have to
realize. Were they indicated, though, in later editions?
Yeah, and some of them, they're indicated, that's correct, yeah.
You mean Feinstein's notations are also in here?
No.
In a later edition?
No, but if you had, let's say, a newly published edition of the Gemara, which isn't simply a photograph of what you have over here in traditional Vilna Shas, then you would find an edition. Some of the commentaries, or some of the notes, or the comments, and so on, of the Reb Moshe Feinstein.
Okay. So, we're on.
All right, we're on. All right. We've been sort of going back and forth between one Indian and another. I mean, we discussed the business about the spies, if you remember.
Rabbi,
we discussed
what was the Mishnah? Huh? What was in Mishnah?
Oh, the Mishnah is way, way back. Okay. You asked a good question. So let's take a look. The Mishnah began actually on Lamed Beis.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And it started off actually with a discussion of what can be said in any language, but what can only be said in Lashon Kodesh, okay? All right, so that was the beginning. And we discovered, you know, that certain things, such as, for example, Parashat Sota, that's the reason why it's here in this Gemara. In other words, what the Kohen has to say to the Sota, or what the Bezdin has to say when they try to interrogate her, and so on and so forth, that, you know, it could be any language that she speaks. She should understand, you know, what's going on. Not simply in Hebrew. Okay? And from that they branched into some other things, such as the Vidui Miser, which is what a person has to say every third year in the seven-year cycle, the third year and the sixth year, in which he had to make a declaration that he took care of all the obligations he had. He gave his truma, gave his maestros, and so on and so forth. He helped the poor, and so on and so forth. And there wasn't anything left in the house now. And this was normally done just before Pesach, you know, a good time for Pesach, house cleaning, and so on. So he made sure, among other things, also that whatever obligations he had failed to come up with in the past. Declaration. He has to say, "Biyarti Hakodesh Ben Abayis." Right? I have cleaned out whatever is holy from my house, and I've given to the Kohen, the Levi, and so on, to the poor people, to the stranger, even as you have commanded, and I have not violated any of your commandments in this respect, and so on. So again, while there's a formula in the Hebrew and the Torah, but still, he doesn't have to say it in the Hebrew. He could say it in whatever language he understands. Then, of course, after that, it's Kriya Shema and Tefillah. In other words, Shema, for any person who doesn't know how to read in the Hebrew, he can say it in whatever language he understands. The same thing with Shmona Esrei. Same thing, okay? So, naturally, it's important because, after all, the Shema is a declaration of faith on our part. And of course, the Shmona Esrei is prayer. In prayer, you're talking to the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, and if you don't know how to do it in Hebrew, then by all means do it in whatever language you can do. I have no objection, and I see some people over here davening in English. If that's what they understand, then they can't, you know, they can't handle the Hebrew. Gesunta heit. At least I know that they're davening. It's coming from the heart. As the Gemara says Rachmona Liba Boy, in other words, Rabbeinu Shel Olam desires the heart of a human being. This is what he's looking for. So if it comes from the heart, then Rabbeinu Shel Olam pays attention to it, right? And then Birkas Hamazon is another thing. In other words, benching could be done in any language, whatever, okay? And then Shmos Haedus and Shavuos HaPikodon, these are oaths that people have to take for various legal reasons. And the oath could be administered, not necessarily in Hebrew, could be administered in any language that they understand. Okay. But then there are certain things that must be said only in Lashon Kodesh. And what are they? So the first one that they mention is Mikra Bikur. In other words, when people would bring the first fruits to the Beis HaMikdosh, then they were obligated to say certain psukim that we find in the Torah, where first of all he says, you know, Hinei Vesis Parishvat, in other words, I'm thankful to you, O God, I'm bringing the first fruits, what I have, and so on and so forth. And then the Kohen has to take, you know, the basket and help him underneath, because it has to be waved up and down in all directions and so on. And but he also has to make a declaration of Arami Yovid Ovi, just as we say on the Seder night, because those psukim are taken from this section in the Torah, okay? He gives a little history, in other words, the Jewish people, starting with Yaakov Avinu, who was threatened with extinction by Lavanu Arami, right? And then the people of Israel went to Egypt, and the suffering that they endured over there, and finally God took us out from there, and so on. So he has to say all these psukim, and he says, "And now behold, I have brought the first fruits of the land, you know, which you have given unto me." So that has to be said in Hebrew, okay? one who disputes about the halakha, essentially, is that it should be said in Hebrew. Okay, we should have a binyan based on Mikdash and be able to bring first fruits again over there and learn these psukim. Okay, as a matter of fact, the Kohen would say it in order to make sure that whoever came would be able, you know, not to feel ashamed. So even if they knew how to say it on their own, so nevertheless, the Kohen would be, as we would say, he was makri. In other words, he would be sayed, and then they said it after him. Okay? And that way, nobody would have to be put to shame. I mean, it's sort of like what we do over here with the, you know, the reading of the Torah. Right? It's a similar thing. Okay?
No, in those days, they didn't have written books which they can learn. So they had to learn it either by rote or by someone teaching.
Yeah, all right. Obviously, there were copies of Sifrei Torah around, but still, not everybody had it. Now, for instructional purposes, we learned that they used to write psukim on what they called the Megillahs. In other words, you know, sections. And then people would study them in Talmud Torah, in the Cheder, whatever you want to call it, and study with the Rebbe and so on, until finally they had practically memorized the text and understood, you know, what it was about. But nevertheless, in order not to shame it. Now, of course, originally everybody read their own little section of the Torah.
Well, they still do that in the Sephardic too.
Yeah, well, you could do it, Gesundheit. I mean, I'm more than happy to encourage people to do it. But nevertheless, because the average person cannot simply open up a Sefer Torah and begin to read it and chant it with the Ta'amim, you know. So, in that case, that's why we do it on behalf of everybody who gets the Torah. And you're supposed to say it, so not in a soft voice, you know, to follow with the reader.
Right.
It's not something to stand by and
observe.
And observe, right, or talk to the Gabbai or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay. And then there are other passages, too, that they mention. Primarily among them, first of all, I mean, chalitza, there are certain things that the woman who requires chalitza, she has to say certain sentences from the Torah in order to be released of the obligation, and then certain things that we'll be having later on. One of them is, well, one that's mentioned and that we're still working with, that we'll have in this evening, I hope, in Yirtzeh Hashem, and that is the brachos and klolos. These were the blessings and the curses that were recited in the presence of the people once they crossed the Jordan and came to Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal, and so six of the tribes faced one and six of the tribes faced the other direction, the Kahanim and the Leviim in the middle, and they said, you know, Baruch Ha'ish, happy, blessed is the man who has never made an idol. And the opposite, when they turned over there, would be, cursed be the man who makes an idol. We only have the negatives, but it's understood that from the negative that we find in the Torah, that the affirmative was just the opposite.
It's a blessing.
Yeah, right. In other words, where it says, for example, Arur, Mashke Yiver Badera, okay? Cursed is the man who causes the blind to stumble in the way. So naturally, what would be, you have to say, you know, Baruch HaYesh Asher Lo Yashke Yiver Badera, right? Blessed is the man who does not cause the blind to stumble in the way. Or Arur Masigavul Reyehu, you know, cursed is the man who removes literally the boundary mark that belongs to his
neighbor.
So the bracha obviously would be Baruch Shalom Masig Vulrayehu or something like that. So or maybe Baruch Matziv Vulrayehu, because that's a possibility that might be the opposite. Whatever it may be. But at any rate, this is, you know, we can understand, you know, what the idea is.
Right.
All right, so that we'll come to a little bit later tonight. And then some of the other things that we'll come to in the near next few weeks would be, for example, the Birkas Kohanim, which the Kohanim must recite in Hebrew. They cannot recite in any language, whatever, in order to fulfill the obligation to Duchen. You understand? And then, of course, the Birkas Kohen Gadol, that would be the blessing that the Kohen Gadol had to recite on Yom Kippur. He had a whole series of blessings that he had to make at that time. Okay, and then we have Egla Rufa, Meshuch Milchomo, and so on. I mean, the Egla Rufa is, you know, this is for somebody that's found murdered, and in that case, there's a whole ceremony The upshot of which is, you know, that people have to say, Yodeinu l'shofetz hadam hazeh, our hands are not shed this blood, b'yinin l'ru, our eyes do not see, and then we say, Kapil li'amcha Yisrael, asher p'dis ha'lashem. Forgive your people, Israel, whom you have redeemed, O God, and do not cause innocent blood, you know, to be shed in this land, and so on. Okay, so that has to be said in the Hebrew. Or the last thing that they mentioned over there, it was the Parashas HaMelech, yes. Well, the Parashas HaMelech. What is Parashas HaMelech? That's when they had what they call the ceremony of Hakel. Every year, at the conclusion of the Shemitah Yoher, right, during Chol HaMoed Sukkos, they would gather in Yerushalayim in the temple. They would erect a great big bima, and the Kohen, the king would actually read a portion of Sefer Devarim to the people, you see. So that, naturally, he didn't read it in Chinese, he had to read it, of course, in Hebrew, okay? And finally, last but not least, I mean, the thing that they mentioned over there, there is a Kohen called the Mishuach Milchoma, in other words, he's been anointed to serve in battle. And when Jews went forth in order to do battle against the enemy, he had to make certain declarations. As for example, is there a man over here who has married within the year and it's not yet, you know, had a chance, for example, to be together with his marriage, with his wife and so on, all right? So he's excused. Same thing if he bought a field and he has not yet been able, you know, to get a harvest from it, or he built a house, has been able to dedicate it, and so on and so forth. Okay, so these ideas, and then of course the last one is anybody who is afraid, also excuse and go home, so that the rest of the people don't lose their courage, okay? So this had to be said by the Kohen, who is especially pointed to that, also in Hebrew. So these are formulas that had to be said in Hebrew. All right, now, one of the things that they mention in the Mishnah is also about the stones that the people of Israel erected in the days of Yehoshua, okay? And therefore, just like a couple of weeks ago, we read how when they crossed the Jordan River, there were all kinds of miracles that took place, and one of the things that they had to do is also to set up 12 stones, and that they should be as a memory so that people should remember, and the children in turn should also recognize the fact that God performed a great miracle in redeeming the people of Israel, and the miracle was also for the purpose that Israel should know that this is the land that they are to inherit. In other words, Jews should not despise Eretz Israel, but they should realize that it's a God-given gift unto us.
At what point was Hebrew? Was it that you said? Now let's start with the slavery of the slaves.
Okay.
Not at that point?
Prior
to the slaves?
Yes, of course.
Okay.
Yes. In other words, with Abraham, we're already talking Hebrew.
Oh, yeah.
Okay?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. I mentioned a few weeks ago, I once heard a lecture, maybe had to be about 60 years ago or so, which the lecturer said, he was a big man in Boston in those days, a man by the name of Levinson Lovey. He was in charge of Jewish education of Boston, okay? So gave a lecture in order to say that the first Hebrew speaker was Terach. Abraham learned from Terach how to speak Hebrew. That's original theory, but I don't know who else ever agreed with the Levinson Lovey.
Tataro, who taught Abraham how to speak Hebrew.
Okay, the rabbinic Shalim taught it. But on the other hand, we also have a tradition that says that Adam and Eve already also spoke Lashon Kodesh, right? You understand? And of course, in the Tower of Babel, obviously, among the various nations, the different languages, one of them had to be Lashon Kodesh also. So you can go back, you know, to that. How do we know that Adam and Eve spoke Hebrew? Anybody have a theory?
God spoke to them.
Huh?
God spoke to them.
Yeah, okay.
He was supposed to name different species.
Yeah, okay. But actually, one of the easy things is the fact that you have the word Ish and the word Isha. Man and woman, right? And of course, I mean, you can see already, I mean, that from the word Ish and the word Isha, that Hebrew actually had to be, you know, the language spoken, because otherwise it doesn't make sense. I mean, what is the feminine of the word Adam? You have to say Chava, but obviously, you know, they're not, you understand? But Ish and Isha, this is easy enough to
say. Well, that's because the Torah was written in Hebrew, but describing it. But they could have spoken in sign language, who knows what they spoke.
But since you asked the question, I'm giving you some answers, okay? By the way, we learned early, a long time ago when we started learning Sota at that time, that the rabbis noticed that in the word Ish, it's spelled Aleph Yud Shin, right?
Uh-huh.
And Isha is spelled Aleph Shin Hey, okay? So in other words, what do we find? We find that when God is among them, the Yud and the Hey, so therefore, you know, there is peace in the family and you have a good union. If on the other hand, the Rabbeinu Shalilim is missing from there without the Yud and without the Hey, then what do we have left? We have the letters Aleph Shin Eish.
Eish.
In other words, fire, right? So then you have a fiery situation at home, you see. So, okay, yeah. All right, let's get back over here. So, I mentioned that, you know, the Gemara has sort of been going back and forth from what we've been having over here, talking about what happened with the spies, talking about what happened with King David in bringing the Ark to Yerushalayim, and, you know, the whole incident with Uzzah, the, you know, the fact that he was smitten because he dared to touch the ark, and of course, what was the problem? So, according to one authority, we read it because it should have been carried on the shoulders of the Levim, the way the ark was carried in the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, right? And it wasn't. They put it in the wagon, and that's why the problem occurred. In other words, it's sort of like a mark of disrespect for the Aron, I mean, to carry it in the wagon, pulled by oxen, as compared to carrying it on the shoulders. Other parts of the Mishkan were carried, you know, the poles and the, you know, the all the coverings that they needed for the tents and everything else and so on. I mean, the wooden pieces of wood that they needed in order to make, you know, a fence all around, you know, and sand. These they carried in wagons, but not the most holy things. And of course, the ark was probably the most holy, certainly ranking among the first, together like, you know, let's say the Shulchan, the Menorah, you know, which, you know, they were the holiest items. The same thing, of course, was true of the Mizbeach. So we had two altars. Remember, one was the Mizbeach HaZohav, the golden altar, which was used for Ketores, for the incense, and the other one was used for the sacrifices themselves, okay? All right. So now he comes back again to the business that we had already mentioned before about the stones. All right. And now we come up with a new theory over here. All right. So this is where we start tonight. Nimsei Sato Omer. So getting back to the discussion, he says, you can say that Shlosha Mine Avonim Hoyu. Says, in reality, there were not just one set of stones that Joshua set up, but in reality, we find, if we analyze the text, that there were three different types of stones that come into existence. Okay, Echad Shehekim Moshe Eretz Moab, one of them that Moshe Rabbeinu set up in the land of Moab. In other words, this is while he was still on the other side of the Jordan. Remember, that's where he died. He died in the land of Moab. Okay. Shenemar, as the Pasuk says, Be'ever HaYarden, in the other side of the Jordan, Be'eretz Moab, in the land of Moab, Ho'il Moshe Be'eretz HaTorah Hazos. Moshe began, actually, Ho'il, the usual meaning is that he was willing, but here it's better translated as began to explain the words of the Torah. Okay? And what is the word that means to explain over here? So it's Be'er, okay? Ulahalon, and then later on, what does it say? Omer, it says, Bechosafta Lehen, it's called Divrei HaTorah Hazos. You are to write upon them, meaning upon the stones, right? All the words of the Torah, right? But, you know what's missing over here in the quotation? The words Ba'er Hetev, which means, and explain it well. Now, Our sages take the word ba'er, explaining, okay, in the sense that it is to be explained so that any person, any language throughout the world would be able to understand the teachings of Torah. Okay? So that, getting back over here, on the basis then of what we call a gezeirah shavah, in other words, a similarity of language. So if it says ba'er and ba'er, so we have to assume, therefore, that what? That just as in the latter sentence, the latter situation, Moshe Rabbeinu was commanded to take 12 stones and set them up, and was also commanded, incidentally, to plaster them or whitewash them, whatever you want to call it. I mean, the word seed in Hebrew could either mean one or the other, either plaster or whitewash, okay? So, therefore, we say then that Moshe Rabbeinu, actually, while he was still in Moab, already also set up 12 stones, okay? All right, so that makes, that accounts now for two sets of stones, right? Okay, the Yechod Shehekim Yehoshua B'socha Yarden. And then there was one that Joshua set up in the middle of the Jordan as they crossed. So he also selected 12 stones. Shenema, as the Pasuk says in the book of Joshua, Ushteim Esrei Avonim Hekim Yehoshua B'socha Yarden, right? That Joshua erected 12 stones in the midst of the Jordan. The Echad, and the, so that was actually the second, because the first one, they were only trying to prove that Moshe Rabbeinu, he was commanded to take 12 stones, okay, and but that, where was it set up? That was still in the land of Moab, okay? And so the second one is the stones that he had in the midst of the Jordan. The Echad Shehekim Ba'Gilgal. And then a third set of stones is what Joshua set up in Gilgal. Gilgal is already on the Israeli side of Canaan, right? That was really the first place where they encamped after they crossed the Jordan. Shenemar, as it's written over there, the Eshtem Esrei Havonim Va'ela Shelokhu, right? And these 12 stones that they took, they set up in Gilgal. Alright, so according to this count, we have three different sets of stones, okay? One that Moshe Rabbeinu left somewhere on the other side in the land of Moab. One, stones in the middle of the Jordan, marking the place where the Kohanim crossed together, you know, bearing the Ark of God with them. And then the 12 stones that they set up in Gilgal itself. All right. So now, the Gemara asks the following question. Don Rabbon, all right, says, Ketzad Kotvu Yisrael is HaTorah. How did the people of Israel write the Torah? Okay, so you'll say, what do you mean, how did they write the Torah? But the answer is that Moshe Rabbeinu was commanded to write, it says, V'chosafta Aleihem Es Divrei HaTorah Zos V'Yavrecha. Okay, you are to write the words of the Torah on them, okay, on these stones, okay. Also says Bavrecha, which would mean as you cross over, but we'll forget about that part because it's not shayach, as we would say, it's not appropriate to the drash that we have over here. Okay, so according to the drash, Moshe Rabbeinu was told to take these stones, to write the Torah upon them, and also that the stones had to be whitewashed. Okay, you understand? So, or plaster. Let's use the word plaster because it's a thicker cover than whitewash. All right. So, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, he says, Al Gabe Avonim Ksavuho. First, he says, they wrote the text on the stones. Shenemar, as the Pasuk says, V'cholsatol Avonim is called Divrei HaTorah Hazois, right? You have to write on these stones all these words of the Torah. V'yachakach, and afterwards he says, Sodu Osam Basid. Then they covered it with the plaster. So Amalu Rabbi Shimon. So Rabbi Shimon says to Rabbi Yehuda, hey, that doesn't make sense, he says. Lidvarecha, according to what you say, Eich lomdu umo yishaloyso hasman Torah, how did the nations of the world at that particular time learn the words of Torah? After all, if we have the tradition that what? That ba'er hatev means in Shivim Lashon, in other words, the 70 known languages at that time, so that everybody should be able to understand the words of Torah, and know what God's message is to the world, right? So if they're going to read it from the stones, and then the words are all covered up with plaster, so how would they be able to read it? So that's the question that he asked them. So Amalo, so Rabbi Yehuda answers him. He says, "Bino Yisevan Asam Behem Hakadosh Baruch Hu." Says the Rabbeinu Shleilam gave him special. That is, he gave the goyim the Yumos Olam. All right, he gave them special understanding. The Shigron Notirin Shalahem, and they send their scribes. Notirin, you know, it's like the word notary in English. Mm-hmm. It's the same. You know, it's derived from the same Latin root. Okay. So they sent their notaries, they sent their scribes. The kilpus hasid, and what did they do? They peeled off, the kalef means to peel, right? So they peeled off the plaster from it, the hisiyuho, and then, you know, they copied down, you know, whatever it was that, you know, they saw written over there. So that's how they learned, okay? But that being the case, the aldover zeh nischatim tzadinu leveil shachas. In that case, then their fate was decided that eventually, you know, that they would inherit Gehinnom. Why? Shehoyelahen lilmod, because as long as they had the text of the Torah to learn, they were supposed to learn it. The law lomdu, but they didn't learn it. So that therefore the Rebbeinu Shalom will punish them for it. Of course, Tosfos points out a different thing. Tosfos points out that points out the fact that we do have a different passage in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah. Okay, Avodah Zarah, it says over there that you know, the peoples of the world, they came to the Rebbeinu Shalom, they came with a Taina. They said, if we had known what the Torah was all about, we would have accepted it. You remember, you know, it's based upon the idea that the Rebbeinu Shalom first came to the Umos Ha'olam, and they said to them, are you willing to accept the Torah? And this nation says, what's in it? And the Rebbeinu Shalom said, thou shalt not kill. Another one says, thou shalt not commit adultery. And thou shalt not steal. And of course they say,
yeah. That's our occupation.
That's our occupation, exactly. Adultery, schmaltery, right? If the president can do it, well, can we, you know?
Why not?
Yeah. And the same thing with stealing. What stealing, you know, from somebody else? Begman, you know, if it's not your own, you know. I don't have to tell you, right? And murder, you know, there are people who justify murder too, you say, for whatever it may be. So they refused to accept the Torah. Then, you know, in spite of the fact that the Rebbeinu Shalom had asked them and they rejected it, so still they said, well, look, they said, you're still playing favoritism. What is the favoritism? Favoritism is that when the people of Israel stood at Mount Sinai, so there is a tradition that says that the Rebbeinu Shalom is kof aleihem har kegigis. In other words, literally, he covered them. He lifted up the mountain, so to speak, where they were, and he held it over them like, you know, the cover of a pot or something, like a pot cover. And he said that if you accept the Torah, fine. And if not, then I'll bury you over here. So you never gave us that chance, they kept on saying. All right. So then, of course, the Gemara of Avodah Zarah says, okay, Rebbeinu Shalom says, all right, I'm convinced. So I'll give you a very easy mitzvah to perform. And what is that easy mitzvah? The answer is building a sukkah. So they went out and they built themselves sukkahs. And then what happened? So it was a very, very hot day. Yeah. To use the idiom in the Gemara over there, it says, Hotzi HaKadosh Baruch Hu Chama Menatika. The Rebbeinu Shalom took out the sun from its sheath. You know, it's as if it were right. Right? And then, you know, it got so hot that they didn't want to stay in the sukkah anymore. But not just they didn't want to stay in the sukkah. What did they do? They kicked their sukkahs down. It's a sign of contempt for the whole business and so on. So that being the case, then obviously the Umay Sohilim were not minded, you know, to accept the Torah. Well, of course, we're living in an age, I don't have to tell you where we have, but even in the days of the Gemara, I mean, they knew that they were pious goyim too, you know. As, for example, the other day we heard this lecture of Tisha B'Av, if you remember,
yeah.
And the reference was to Rebbe, and who was his very close friend? It was Antoninus. Who was either Antoninus Pius, who was one of the Roman emperors, or according to the lecture, he was, you know, like the governing general or something like that. But at any rate, he and Rebbe were very close. And they discussed Gemara and things like that, and so on and so forth. So he was among the Chassidei Yom HaSoilam, right? And of course, we have the Gemara, you know, that says that Chassidei Yom HaSoilam Yeshtem Chelkum Haba. They all have a share in the world to come, as long as they are pious, in other words, they observe and so on. And then we know, too, that what happened in the days of Noah? They were already given mitzvahs. Okay, what kind of mitzvahs? What we call Sheva mitzvahs b'nei yodim, right? Not to steal, not to blaspheme, that they should have courts of law, not to murder, not to eat what we call an eva menachai, in other words, to take a living animal and just tear limbs from it and so on. So they have their instructions. Matter of fact, we would be very happy if the goyim would observe these Sheva mitzvahs b'nei yodim, because that way, at least we would know, you know, that they're living
pious, yeah.
Civilized and a religious life. I mean, we don't object to the fact that they have a different religion, but we want them to live an ethical life, which would be in consonance with the words of the Torah. And this is the thing. So,
you got a little paradox here. God instructs them to put up the stones of Moshe and put all the words of the Torah on it.
Right, right.
And it says plaster it.
Yeah.
And then it says peel it off.
Right. Well, then they came and they peeled it off, right.
That's a paradox.
In order to be able to read. No, that's his opinion.
Yeah, okay.
All right, so we'll come to the contrary of it.
That's right, okay. Get to that.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So, yeah, now Rav Shimon, he has, there's a different opinion from Rav Yehuda, right? Rav Shimon, says, first, the stones were covered with plaster to begin with. And then they wrote the words of the Torah on the plaster, okay? The kos will ahen mamata, and then right below the words of the Torah that they copied, they put in another, a postscript, a P.S. And what is the P.S.? The P.S. is another pasuk that we have in Sefer Devarim, which is the man asher lo yilamdu etzchem la'asoyis kichol hatoiv oseila, that the goyim should learn the words of the Torah so that they do not teach the people of Israel their own rotten ways. There's a pasuk in Yechezkel where he chides the people of Israel about the fact that, you know, that they didn't learn from the goyim. As well as also, you know, a pasuk in which he chides them for learning from the goyim. So the answer, of course, is, how do you resolve the contradiction? The answer is, you learned only what? The bad things from the goyim. The worst things. But why didn't you learn, you know, the good qualities that the goyim have? Because they have good qualities as well. And that you didn't learn, you see. So that it's important. I mean, look, we're living in a civilization where, I mean, while we believe, you know, that Yiddishkeit is the finest thing in the world for us, and we feel that its ideals should be disseminated among all the people of the world, that they should all live an ethical life and so on. But, you know, at the same time, we have to learn that living among non-Jews, we should try to learn, you know, the best qualities that they have to show us as examples and not the worst qualities. And the tzara with American Yiddishkeit today is that in many cases they learn too much the bad qualities, whatever you want to consider. I mean, whether it's hedonism or whether it's, you know, simply the pursuit of anything but religion and so on. Of course, here I'm not even talking about the even worse ethical problems. I'm talking about even this, you know. For example, you know, I went to visit my sister in Florida. Stayed in an area which is at least 90-95% Jewish, okay? Those Jews, the only time that they ever get into the see the inside of a shul is Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. The rest of the year, nothing. Yiddishkeit is absolutely foreign to them.
Yeah.
Oh, and Coconut Creek. That's what I saw.
Oh, yeah, they have
yeah, so how many people are affected by it, you see? That's the problem.
Yeah, we get 500 people.
Well, that's pretty good.
Yeah? All right. I didn't see it. I saw a bare minion and at that.
Where'd you go?
They have. The only place that I found was outside over there. I don't know.
The conservative show in the shopping center.
Yeah.
They were there. Okay.
Yeah, well, maybe it's different. When I was
the
there,
I came in the afternoon,
discovered that they had a minion at, 3:30 in the afternoon. They were adopting Myrav over there. Of course, I'm not talking already about the fact that the Chasam was facing the Yoylan and so on. But they were davening Myrav. I said, it's too early. I said, Mincha, okay, I can understand, but Myrav? So they said, oh, you say Krishna later. We can only make a minion at this time. We can't get a minion otherwise. So,
I've always said that. Because if you take the percentage who are observing against even the percentage who are there, you're not going to find it. Even if you find a shul that's full, so you have that 500 people, but there's 10,000 more around them. We're not going. See, but he's pointing out to me that he had the same experience here in Florida.
Yeah. Well, don't forget the time of year he was there.
All right.
He was there in August.
Well, it doesn't matter.
A lot of people stay, don't go out.
Yeah, but so it's elementary. If you go to a show where you have 25 people turn out, let's say, for every minute. That's not. If you take that there's another 1,000 Jews all over the place right there available, then.
I understand what you're saying.
We have it here. We have it here.
Yeah, we have it in Springfield.
Sure. People say, I heard a guy say tonight, he's beefing about the fact that only 10 people show up for a minion here and we're struggling. I can't say to him, hey, this is the only time you ever show up.
That's correct, unfortunately.
But he's pointing it to me, but you know, that's true.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. But you know, that's the universal. I wouldn't necessarily blame the Floridian Jews.
Right.
That's
right.
Universal.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, Sam pointed out we have a similar situation here in Springfield. I agree.
Getting back to your point that you brought out, the freedom of choice.
Mm-hmm.
Between good and bad, you know, we're evil.
Yeah, absolutely. We do have a freedom of choice.
It's a tremendous struggle delineated in all religions.
Yeah.
Well.
To do good or do evil.
Yeah.
You know, the point is here. You know what I mean? Well, what we learn, if they learn the bad points from the goyim, you know what I'm saying? But the freedom of choice.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going.
Okay. So, from the fact, you know, that the postscript was added to the words of the Torah over there, it says, from this we learn, that if the goyim would, you know, repent, then they would accept them. Okay? Omar Ravi Bar Shela said, my Talmud, the Rabbi Shimon, what is the reason that Rabbi Shimon said, you know, that first they wrote, it didn't plaster right, and then after that, you know, they wrote on top of the plaster, okay? So he says, Behoyu Amim Isfafosit, because we have a pasuk in Yeshayahu which says that the nations will be like burnt in plaster. Well, you know, sometimes they get a pasuk and just that they see the word Sid over there, the Hoyo Amim, so therefore, you know, they tie it in with this over here. Right. Okay. So, in other words, Al Iske Sid. In other words, why will they eventually deserve burning in Gehinnom? It's if they don't observe what they found written on the plaster. This is how we have to understand it. The Rabbi Yehuda, how about him, you know, who said that first the words were written on the stone and then covered with plaster, right? And then, therefore, what did the Umas Ha'olam have to do? They had to go and have their right and peel it off. So he says, Kisid. He says, Sid. He says, Ma Sid, Ein Lo Itakon El Sreifa. He says, just as the plaster, there's nothing they can do in order to fix it up unless you burn it. So Afosim Akusim, Ein Lo Itakon El Sreifa. So likewise, those goyim, you know, who do not obey God's laws, so the only way in which they can have a tikkun would be also for burning. So it says, come on, Aslo Hodetanya Vishavisu Shivyar. So now they ask the following question. It's written in Parsha, you know, Kiseitse and so on, right? Actually, it's the story over there about what we call the. You know, the woman, they go out to war, right? And they see a beautiful woman. And, you know, he has cheshek for her. So in that case, what happens? He takes her into the house, and she has to mourn for her parents for a month and so on. And then, you know, the after that, right, and so on. Yeah, the whole deal, right? Right. And so, you know, and then after that, if he wants, he can take her for a wife and so on. Okay. So, it's what we call it in the Hebrew, it's referred to as Yifas Toyah, okay? The woman who is beautiful in appearance, all right. So, the Pasuk begins, Kiseisei la milchom ado yivecho, right? When you go out to make war against your enemies, right? And then it says, Bishavisa shivyo, and you will take him captive, okay? So, the question is, here they were told to do what? That when they made war against the Shivas Amim, in other words, seven people, seven nations that were living in Canaan, that they weren't allowed to do what?
Oh, they weren't allowed to
marry. To marry them, marry. Not only that, but they weren't allowed also to keep them alive and so on. In theory, they had to exterminate them all, right? Okay. This was a theory. Okay. So, what do you do? If, of course, it doesn't mean that all the nations in Canaan were only, you know, seven. There were more than that. I mean, we understand, right? But specifically, the Torah mentions, you know, Kanani, Chiti, Brizi, and so on, Chivi, and so on. You understand? Okay, these people. Now, question is, what if you had people of this group who were not living in Eretz Israel at the time? You understand? Who were living outside of Eretz Canaan. So what's the story over there? So he says, "Vishavisa shivyo." This refers to them, namely what? The rabos, that's to include Canaanim shebechusel oretz. This is to include these Canaanite people who were living outside of Eretz Israel. Sheim chozer mitshuva, mekabenosa. That if they do tshuva, in other words, they are willing, you know, to live a good life, they're willing to accept Yiddishkeit, whatever it may be, then in that case, we receive them. They are not to be destroyed. It's only those within the land itself, but not others, even though they belong to the same nationality. Okay. So he says, come on. This is in accordance with whom? He says, Kerab Shimon. They would be, you know, this would be in accordance with Rab Shimon's opinion, as Rashi says on the top over there, the Yomar Shekosav Lahem Sheyasu B'Shua, who said, you know, that there was a postscript urging the nations, you know, that they should be chozer b'tshuva, that they should repent and come back to and be willing, you know, even to accept the teachings of Yiddishkeit, okay?
Which is the point that the rabbi, like which
the rabbi means in order to include.
I know, but which word made him...
Oh, why does it say v'shavisav shivyo, right?
As opposed to
what? That's what the Pasuk says, and so on.
Right, so
but after all, who were they making war against? They were told, you know, instructed to make war against who? Against the Canaanites, right? So that, therefore, this problem would arise in accordance with Rabbi Shimon. If the postscript was written that they should be chozer b'tshuva, and that shouldn't teach their evil customs to the people of Israel. So in that particular case, how could there be Canaanites who would be chozer b'tshuva? So the answer is they weren't living in Eretz Yisrael. They were Canaanites living outside of Eretz Yisrael. And for them, it is possible. So that's this is what he's saying, okay?
No, I'm just asking, yeah. What should he have said if it wasn't, you know, which is the word that's telling us that there's
well,
an extra thing that comes
from? Okay. Apparently, Rabbi Yehuda lays the stress upon the fact that they should be destroyed or something. He didn't accept the idea, you see. Whereas Rabbi Shimon did accept it, because Rabbi Yehuda, according to him, if you remember, you know, they had an opportunity to learn, and they simply sent their notaries before the plaster was put on. But it doesn't say over there, in the concept of Rabbi, you know, with what Rabbi Yehuda said, he didn't say that a postscript was added, you know, that Manu Yilamdu Eshem Lasses Kotevos Vayelam. See? So that therefore there is a difference of opinion between one and the other. And obviously Rabbi Shimon is the one who feels that Canaanites can be Chosun B'Tshuva. Okay? Okay.
How this?
Yes.
This though, how the Canaanim or the Hivim, whatever, are yeah. outside Israel. What, by what power are the Israelis going to be able to go and exterminate these people?
No. So the Israelis never had the power to go and exterminate them. The question is only, however, that. Can they be accepted if they want to become Jews, for example? They want to be Megayer, okay? Can you accept them? So that this is the really the issue over here. But I extend it a little bit because I say that Chozer B'Tshuva not only means, you know, that are they permitted to be Megayer, you know, become Jewish, but I say even to be Chozer B'Tshuva in the sense that let them live at least, you know, the kind of an ethical life that the Rebbeinu Shel Olam wants of all the nations of the world. Okay, so now the Gemara continues and says, take a look, he says, and see how many different miracles happen on that very day. In other words, the day that they crossed the Jordan, right? First of all, Ovru Yisrael Sayyadin, that's the first miracle, that they were able to cross the Jordan. Of course, we already read about how the fact, you know, that the waters of the Jordan became like they were held back, right? So that the Jews had dry land upon which to pass, and it wasn't until all the Jews had passed, and then the Kohanim, who stood in the middle of the Jordan, you know, they lifted their feet from the stones upon which they were standing, you know, that then the waters, you know, came rushing back and so on. Okay? So that's one miracle. And then the Bo'ol Ahar Grizim L'Hashem.